My deep appreciation of theater history was instilled in me by Tom Empey, a college mentor to me and hundreds of others. While teaching Greek theater terms, he would grab the fabric of his slacks and say, "You see these pants? Euripides, Eumenides," making light of content that could be considered rather dry and stuffy while still maintaining respect for the art, which is what I want to do with this podcast. For each episode, I invite a guest from the many paths my theater career has taken me down. I give my guest no idea what we'll be talking about, but they know we're going to find an outrageous story about theater history and perhaps get a better understanding about why we're still doing it after all these years. So welcome to Euripides Eumenides, and I am your host, Aaron Odom. Apocalypse, I said, why you want to show up now? Just when the heart of my life was getting good. I'll give you one more chance. Walk on out of the door, yeah. Get your ass to getting where the getting is good. Good morrow, Eumenidites. This is Aaron Odom from Trident Theater, bringing you another episode of Euripides Eumenides, a theater history podcast. On this podcast, I've done several episodes on the creation of a great role. Sir Anthony Scher playing Richard III, Patti LuPone playing Evita on Broadway, etc. And for this episode, I'm dipping my toes in a pretty academic pool as I look at my bookshelf behind me and can easily spot about 4 or 5 books specifically on this subject. But as an actor, I do love seeing what has come before as it may inform a performance I have yet to do. Today, the topic is Arthur Miller's classic play Death of a Salesman and the many actors who have played the main character of Willie Loman specifically on Broadway. There's a lot to discuss in this topic. My guest and I found so much to talk about that I'm actually going to have to split this episode into 2 parts, because in order to understand the approach to each version of Willie Loman, it's important to understand his origin story on Broadway. As a guest for this episode, I welcome to the show Tracy Burns. Tracy was a pretty influential figure in my theater career, as Tracy taught me improv in college. And as you can have guessed from the times I've talked about it on the show, improv is a pretty big thing in my theater approach. Since then, Tracy has taught in many capacities over the years and is now at the California College of the Arts in San Francisco, where her focus is pretty special. I'll let her talk about it in the episode. But now that the stage is set, we should probably get right into it. Here's the first part of Death of a Salesman and playing Willie Loman on Broadway. Avada, avada, avada,
avada. Oh, man, Tracy, it's so good to see you again.
It is so good to see you.
So many years. You know what? It just popped into my head, and I don't know if you still do this one anymore, and I've forgotten the name. I have the playbill because I had to go see it for a directing class when I was at Pepperdine. Your one-woman show about fairy tale characters and their happily ever afters.
Yes, I remember that production in the little black box at Pepperdine, and here's the fun fact. The dress that I was wearing got shrunk in the wash somehow and was so obscenely short, as I remember, that I was embarrassed the whole time because I'm wearing this really short dress in front of all of my students at Pepperdine University. So yeah,
and we're like, "Hi, Tracy."
Waving. I know. I'm like, "Wow, oh my God, what happened to my dress? It's way too small." But yeah, it was that show has had several incarnations over the years. The Glass Slipper ain't all it's cracked up to be, and
that's
all fairy tale characters and what's happened to them since Happily Ever After. But it's been a number of years since I've done it, and I've been thinking about it lately, going, it'd be nice to. It's fun to do it at different ages. Because I have new insight. It's my writing, but I have new insight into the characters or new insight and just from age, you know, which is fun.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, you did that 20 years ago. And the one that sticks out in my mind is Sleeping Beauty went on to become like an aerobics instructor.
Yes.
Which makes me think now, like, would we be pushing her into Pilates land or CrossFit? I don't know.
She'd probably be spinning. Probably be on a bike. Oh my God, that would be so great if she was on a bike spinning.
Oh, she's the new Peloton coach.
Yes.
And Peloton, we're looking for sponsorship. So
There you go.
Yeah, you've heard our cries.
Yeah. She, everything was about staying awake because she never wanted to fall asleep again because she was afraid she'd never wake up. So she was just like just maxed out of energy all the time and about how much you could get done in a short amount of time. Yeah, she was very amped.
Oh, I remember that very, very well. That was very fun. But since then, it sounds like you have had just a stellar career, doing all kinds of cool and interesting things. And one of the things that I love that you're currently teaching at
California College of the Arts.
That's it. Okay.
In San Francisco.
That's so cool. But I love the idea that you teach acting to animators. Mm-hmm. So what is that all about?
So the way that I describe it is that animators know the how of movement. You know, they know how a character moves. I help teach them why a character moves. So all of the things that we do as actors, you know, what's my motivation, objective, obstacles, actions, all of those things, they are creating a performance, but a live action actor gets to do all of it, right? Their face, their voice, their body. It's all them, but a performance in animation is across many departments. You have the voice actor, you have, and then depending on how big the studio is, how many animators are animating that one character. So you have this performance is now going across a lot of hands. And why does the character pick up the glass? Not just the character picks up the glass and I know how to articulate a hand, but if you don't know why the character is picking up the glass, there's no performance there. So I don't even always say acting anymore because it scares animators. but I say that, you know, you're behavior creators. It's not as, it doesn't sound as good as acting, but it's basically you are creating the behavior that characters do. Through that behavior, the audience gets the story. So narrative, anything that has a story, if there are characters involved, 95% of that story is told through the characters. So you've got to create the behavior and how they relate to each other that gets interpreted by the audience. And that tells the story. And if you don't do that effectively, then we just sit there and go, oh yeah, it doesn't look real. It looks cartoony and it looks uninformed, you know?
I have a couple thoughts on that. My older son, Mike, appeared on my show when we talked about how The Lion King is in relation to Hamlet. And he hates the live action Disney version.
Who doesn't?
Because it's so bonkers to try to see lions have human emotions.
I don't even understand why you, I do with a lot of my students I have them, I want you to find a good acting in animation and bad acting in animation. And I can't tell you how many times that one comes up. because it really is just, and yet the animated version has some beautiful acting and beautiful
animation. Oh my God. Yeah, absolutely.
But the live action, right? CG version, is, I don't even know.
It's strange.
Sorry, Disney.
No, that's okay. I think they've heard it. But the other idea is I actually just got done teaching an 8-week directing course for senior citizens in my community. And it was very cool. And we just sat down for a while and talked about what it's like to like actually consider being a director of a live action play. And a lot of them were really daunted by the idea. They're like, that just sounds huge. And some of them still felt like that when we were done. But by the end of it, we got these rich, robust ideas about how to present pieces of work. And when we got to the section on acting and how to direct actors, that was one thing I was really sure to focus on is like, don't focus on the emotion necessarily, focus on why the emotion happened. You know, like the emotion is a reaction. It should be, as David Mamet suggests, a byproduct of the scene that's going on. In a way.
Exactly. Well, we don't do emotions. We have emotions.
Right.
And acting is about doing. Mm-hmm. So the way I talk about it is emotions can motivate behavior. Emotions can be the result of behavior. Mm-hmm. But they aren't the behavior themselves. They aren't the actions themselves. They aren't the tactics themselves. We can feel, and it's so hard to get across to direct, especially in animation, because I work with directors in animation too. Like I work with the directors at Pixar and some other places, and it's super fun. But everybody talks in emotions. Everybody talks in emotions. And it's that, you know, be madder. She needs to be madder. She needs to be angrier. It's like, that doesn't tell you anything.
No.
What does she do because of that? And the difference between being in the character's emotional state and playing an emotion.
Yes.
And that is a tough concept.
I know. Yeah.
It's a really tough concept to get. I just parenthetically, I was just grading my students' homework on, they finished their big scene and I have all the debrief questions. And what direction was most helpful to you? And then was there any direction that was confusing? And I can't tell you how many students time. It was really great when the director, the instructor said, you know, that I really needed to have more fear in this, or I needed to play the emotion. I'm like, I never said that. I don't say that. That is exactly the opposite of what. So tomorrow we will be having a nice big discussion about, okay, let's go over this again. Because
I'm glad you picked that up, but that is completely false.
If that's how you're interpreting what I'm saying, it's your interpretation. That is not what I'm saying.
Interpretation. There we go. Okay, I found the link. I found the hook. Well, that is so cool. And that's going to be our little journey into our episode today. Okay, so Tracy, you've never done this before. Don't want you to have any jitters. We're good. But I did kind of spice this up with a question I was going to ask you. Okay. And your background is primarily not traditional theater. It's more improvisational but like teaching acting and stuff. But nonetheless, what's your favorite play to be revived and why? Like, if you see this play is going to be produced, you're like, oh, I better go get a ticket.
That's a different question that I don't have one of those.
Oh, okay.
But I've thought about like what would be a good play to revive. And the thing that came to my mind was Lysistrata.
Oh my word.
I would love to see a modern Lysistrata. There's a modern film version that Spike Lee did, which is Chirac, and it's a drama. I want to see a comedy. And it's in verse. Chirac is in verse, but it's
I didn't even know drama. About that.
Oh yeah, it's about gang violence, but it's Lysistrata.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's all in verse. And I'd love to see a modern Lysistrata, because boy, do we need some kind of art to reflect life, to go look at. If all the women in the world said, "We ain't giving it up until you stop fighting," maybe we would not have war.
But we want to do that. That's why we're fighting. I'm seeing it like a very Python-esque thing already. Oh my, I love
something.
It.
Yeah. The other thing, I always wanted to do Taming of the Shrew, and I had a version of Taming of the Shrew that I wanted to do, which was that Kate and Petruchio are wrestlers. And they both are like, what is it? Wrestlers. And then Bianca, this was a while back, so talk about aerobics again. Bianca is like an aerobics instructor. Now she would probably be Pilates.
Right.
And she's kind of an airhead. And then Grumio, who's Petruchio's servant, you read, especially the beginning when Petruchio's knocking on the door, Grumio sounds like a punch drunk trainer. You know, he's got this whole, he's been hit in the head too many times, you know? And then the whole meet of Kate and Petruchio where they fight would be in a wrestling ring.
Oh.
And they would actually wrestle. I wanted to do that so bad. I wanted to be Kate so bad. And I know there's a lot of problems, the end and all of that kind of stuff but my thing on that was always that Kate finally found a man she respected.
Yeah.
I would, you know, it kind of not change her speech at the end, because you don't, but I think with an idea of, look, when you find the person that you respect, you can give way, but I'm not giving way to anybody that I don't respect.
Yeah. Oh, I like that.
And that was where I found my place with the whole misogyny of it. But anyway, that was something I always wanted to do for myself. Like, I wanted to play Kate and I wanted to do this because I really loved stage fighting and I liked wrestling. And so I wanted to do all.
Well, that's interesting to think because, you know, I've been steeped in this subject for the last several days, just researching and typing it out and getting ready. And I'm like, oh man, maybe this is my wish list. Okay, so here we go. Outside of Shakespeare, on Broadway, non-musicals aren't too often revived unless there is some sort of a significant commercial gain, the right cast at the right time to inspire some ticket sales, but also incredible performances. I mean, look, I'm wearing my Sweeney Todd hoodie. I went to see Josh Groban in it. Oh. And now it's Aaron Tveit and Sutton Foster, and it's closing in like 3 or 4 weeks. But that sold tickets for a while because it was Josh Groban and, you know.
And Sutton Foster.
And yes, amazing. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Oh, but she didn't play his. That would have been an interesting juxtaposition. His was Annalee Ashford. And Tracy, she was so good. She was so good. Anyway, but sometimes a play is revived in the most commercial of markets in the world in order to address an artistic need in the country or to address an issue that needs to be discussed. And as I've said many times on this show, the works of Anton Chekhov suggest that while theater can be educational, it shouldn't necessarily be pedantic. You know, you shouldn't cram a message down somebody's throat. Sometimes plays push a message pretty hard, but Chekhov suggests that as theater artists, we shouldn't be answering big questions, but rather we should be asking them with the performance and then allow the audiences to contemplate what they saw and perhaps devise potential solutions. What do you think?
I love that.
Isn't that great?
It is. It is. I think it's true. And I think there's very little. Well, I mean, I can't say there's very little. I don't know what's going on in the world today on any level. But there's a lot of spoon feeding these days and not a lot of curiosity or asking questions, bringing up questions. But I could be absolutely wrong about that. I'm sure that there's theater all over the country that is doing that.
Oh yeah.
Of course. Mm-hmm. But I loved everything you said. I think it's great.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, there's also generational considerations. Mm. You know, I mean, you have these upcoming generations who, like, I'm holding my smartphone right now. And Tracy, our generation, we went from phones on the wall and typewriters to I can send you a text message in this thing right now. We went through all of that. The generations up front, they just have this given to them. If they don't know something, they can look it up. And so that's a difficult place for theater. Then if that's the way we go in that, I actually heard this from the younger generations, just going to a great piece of work and they're going, I didn't get it.
Well, I mean, we have dumbed down our education system. We have removed any critical thought from anything. We've removed the idea of privacy, which I think is also private thoughts. I think that you have thoughts, you think them, you work things through. Now everything is just, I have an idea. I'm going to put it right here. You know, everything is, there's no
like gestation. Yeah.
Yeah. Gestation. And so of course people don't get it. And we have no attention span. That's the other thing. You can't get something if you don't think about it. So our phones and everything, and I know my attention span has changed too.
Yep.
If it's not easy, I don't think about it as much as, I mean, I don't even have the patience but when I'm watching something, if it doesn't catch me right away, I'm like, eh.
Yeah.
And I'm going, yeah. Give it a chance. I'm like, no.
Yeah.
And or if something's done, I mean, every once in a while, something will be compelling enough for me to go, ooh, those are some interesting thoughts. I got to think about that. Who's seen this film or whatever this thing is so I can talk about it with somebody and really like, well, what was that about? And I love that because I love analysis anyway. I love to discuss and debate movies, films, you know, all of it. You know what I mean? I like different points of view on it. I like to hear when I don't agree with somebody. It's super fun to go, ooh, why did you like that? I didn't. I liked it. Why didn't you like it, you know. But there's you have to have patience. You have to have attention span.
Yeah.
To understand something.
Right. So, right. Yeah. Exactly.
And it's changing the art because the kids these days not only are not absorbing this stuff, what kind of art are they going to put out if they can't even sit through something to think about it? Where's the depth in what they create?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, that being said, I do watch some of my students' work, the animation, and there's some very beautiful, deeply personal, lots of things around identity and race and gender, all of these identity issues that they really go into. And so that's really great.
Well, I'm going to go back to what you said about debating things and picking over things. Oh, this is going to be great, Tracy. Obviously, I brought you here for a reason. For this episode, I'd like to discuss one of the most frequently revived non-musicals on Broadway, and more specifically, its central character. For this episode, we'll be discussing Arthur Miller's classic play, Death of a Salesman, and the actors who have played the character of Willie Loman on Broadway.
Okay.
Because I started to look it up, and I'm like, man, how many times has this been done? And it kind of surprised me. But Tracy, take a guess at how many times Salesman has been produced on Broadway.
On Broadway.
Including its original production.
Which was what year?
1949.
49.
Yeah.
10.
Six.
Six.
It's only been on Broadway six times. It's been produced thousands of times all over the world.
Of course.
And Miller has even said, it's not even my most produced play. That's The Crucible. But.
And The Crucible is worth doing over and over and over again.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Witch hunts. Those are fun. By the way, I do have to mention, it was really fun just finding out how many times I would type in this typo in doing research. I kept trying to find Death of a Salsa Man.
I'd like to see that.
That'd be fun.
That would be fun. But it'll be a musical.
Yeah.
So there you
Darn
go.
Darn it. Yeah. Anyway. So for those who don't know, Death of a Salesman circles around Willie Loman, a traveling salesman who, nearing the end of his life, begins to show cracks in his character. The cracks can all be attributed to an absolute devotion to an, air quotes, American dream and the ever-present potential of reaching it or not. But that said, Willie has never reached the dream, and in this play, it seems that he's just starting to realize it. So I don't want to give spoilers. I mean, there are some big spoilers you could give. My last two episodes gave a lot of them, so I'm not.
Well,
doing that.
I think it's okay to give. I mean, it's been around since 1949. Right. Spoilers.
But see, I mean, that just goes back to what we were just talking about. If a kid hears the spoiler, they go, oh, I already know it. I'm not going to go read it.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe
what kid is actually going to go read Death of a Salesman?
And pore over it. Although I pulled it out and started to read the original Arthur Miller's notes. And his stage directions in it. I love it when a playwright is so clear, like they write it out like an essay for you. Where you're like, ah, okay, these are your words, and you are giving me an absolute picture of what this should be. And it was just fun to read that.
I've got a first edition over here, and I thought maybe it'd be worth something, and it is so not. And it's, you know, it's the first edition you see all the time. I mean, I even went, you know, on Abe's Books or whatever, and I'm looking to go, oh, I have a first edition. And it's like, yeah, it's nothing. I also, of course, when I was whatever, you know, 18 or something, wrote my name in it.
Oh.
But I think you can go overboard on the stage directions.
Oh, yeah.
Tennessee Williams.
Oof.
There are times where it's like, and you will lift your left hand here and move here, take a step there and move there. I'm going, wow, dude. I mean, it's just this parenthetical of just like massive, very controlling.
I will say my favorite stage direction comes from Tennessee Williams.
Oh, yeah.
And it is before Stanley Kowalski screams up at Stella in Streetcar Named Desire. You know, the great Stella. He says her name once, you know, hey, Stella. And then he calls up to her again. And this is the stage direction with heaven splitting violence. And then he screams her name, Stella.
Okay, I'll go for that. And that is what I'm talking about. Like, I'm sure you do this too when you're working with actors, is cross out all of this stuff. I mean, you don't have to do it the way that it was written. I mean, it's a guide, but it's like breathlessly, you know, all of that stuff.
With grace.
Yeah, but something heaven-splitting violence, that is such beautiful imagery.
Mm-hmm.
It's such great imagery that how could, and that's what I love, is evocative imagery that makes it's visceral. It gets in your body and all of a sudden it's like, oh, I mean, as soon as you said that, well, I want to play Stanley now. It's like, I want to say that with heaven splitting violence. Like, I want that. Doesn't that become a huge, there's your curiosity too, to go, how do you do that? What does that mean? Where does it come from? Where is it in him that comes in? How does it project out that it splits the heavens? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Isn't that great?
That is fabulous stage direction.
Heaven splitting violence. It tells you exactly what is expected. Now it's just up to the actor to figure out exactly how to do that. And there is plenty of evocative writing like that in Death of a Salesman, and I would highly encourage you to pick up a copy and read through it, or go see a version if you can. And while I'm in an encouraging mood, I'll encourage you to like, share, and subscribe to this show, give a rating or review wherever you're listening. It truly helps the show out and allows it to be heard by more and more people. Plus, follow the show on Instagram. You'll find it at Euripides_Eumenides. Lots of great content there, too. But let's get back to Tracy Burns and hear about the first two actors who have played Willie Loman on Broadway. Now, back to Salesman.
Okay, back to Willie Loman.
Written in 1948, play was originally presented at the Morosco Theater in 1949, and the play is an obvious reaction to the completion of World War II and the American reaction to it. I've said it a few times on the show. I just became the president of our local community theater board, and we kind of took a chance on a production of Waiting for Godot. And I'm like, you know what? This is an opportunity for people who may not get to see a lot of unusual theater to go see a play that challenges some norms. And it was a fantastic production. The director was very, very, very faithful to the idea that Beckett wanted to make it funny. And he loved like Buster Keaton, and he loved old vaudeville comedy and stuff. And I'm like, they did a great job with it. But I kept telling people that that was the European reaction, or representative of the European reaction to World War II. Here's Death of a Salesman, where we just won World War II. We're big winners. We're the top dog. And, you know, like, hey, let's just stick to the plan, the American plan, and everybody will win. So in Miller's play, we're finding out, well, maybe some Americans aren't winning.
Yep.
Here's a great section from Harold Clurman, great theater name, Harold Clurman's review of the original production. Perhaps the chief virtue of the play is the attention that Miller makes us pay to the man and his problem. For the man represents the lower middle class, the $50 a week plus commission citizen, whose dream is to live to a ripe old age doing a great volume of business over the telephone. It was not unusual to hear of this person in the 30s, but in the theater of the 40s, he has once more become the forgotten man.
Yeah. And I mean, ain't it true now, you know?
Oh my God.
Yeah, yes. More so than ever.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
I talk about it all the time. Just what this country's doing. There is no working. I mean, there's no working. It's insane. It's insane.
It's insane.
It would be interesting to, how could you, because it's so mid-century, right? Mm-hmm. How could you, because if there was a production of Death of a Salesman, I would not have any interest in seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
It would not be, it would not compel me to go see it.
Mm-hmm.
But its message, you know, Miller with Crucible and Death of a Salesman, I mean, these things are, if not as important or more important as they were when he wrote them. How could you get people to Death of a Salesman to make it modern, you know, to give it something?
Well, we're going to go through.
Oh, okay, cool. All righty.
Here's another quote, just to kind of round out
the whole idea of what the play is like. We had the wrong dream, says Biff, Willie Loman's son. And what Miller is saying in terms few can miss is that this wrong dream is one that the greater part of America still cherishes.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's so sad. This original production, we're going to talk about it a little bit here. The set design and music has been mused in multiple reviews. The original set designed by Joe Melziner was so cool, Tracy. Like, the house that they lived in was behind a scrim. And for those who, you know, who don't really know theater, it's one of those curtains that you can shine a light behind it and see everything that is behind the curtain. But if you shine a light at in front of the curtain, you can't see anything behind it.
Magic.
It's magic. The house was kind of painted in almost an expressionist style on the scrim. So you saw the outside of the house, and then you could shine a light behind it and see the inside. So you could see Willie and his wife in their kitchen, or maybe he walks upstairs and sits at the foot of the bed, and you can see people in the other parts of the house kind of stirring around and everything. But it was kind of the idea that Miller had, like, they're just kind of walking mindlessly through this house and just kind of following a beat of a drum that, like, they don't really know that they're listening to. You know, they realize it's there, they just can't hear it. And the play travels back and forth between the present and memories from the past, which the memories from the past were lit a lot brighter and more colorful than the scenes in the present. Just so dark. Here's how Willie is described in the play's opening stage directions. He is past 60 years of age, dressed quietly. Even as he crosses the stage to the doorway of the house, his exhaustion is apparent. And throughout the original version of the play, which you could probably look up in your book right there on your shelf, he is referred to as being somewhat smaller, maybe between 5'5" and 5'8", sometimes referred to as a shrimp or shrimpy. And Miller had envisioned him to be this to augment the idea of how big the world was around him, and this tiny man is slowly being crushed beneath it. So I thought, you know, it was a pretty interesting concept. And, you know, clever casting around the central character could really emphasize this theme a lot further.
Absolutely. And I didn't realize he was over 60, which in 1949 is definitely a different 60 than now. And I know, which is really interesting that he's old.
Yeah.
He's old at that point. He's still working.
He's still working.
His children, I always thought of them as more like teenagers, but really if he's 60, they're full grown adults.
Yeah. I think Biff is supposed to be like 32, 34 or something like that.
Yeah. I didn't remember. What's his wife's name?
Linda. Linda.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I want to know more about Linda. Ooh. You know what I mean? Because, like, this is all from the... Yes, it's the American perspective or a perspective on America at the time, but also a definitely a male perspective.
Yes.
As far as the working man and what, you know, men and small men and big dreams and dreams crushed and the American dream. But often there wasn't a lot of room for women in that dream. And especially coming out of World War II, where women had all this power and then it was all taken away.
Yeah.
And I don't remember in this if that's addressed at all. I don't remember if Salesman addresses any of that with Linda. Was she a Rosie the Riveter when in the war? And he didn't go to war because he was too old. Yeah. So anyway.
No, she was ever the dutiful housewife.
Right.
But there have been some interesting productions where the actors playing Linda have really sunk their teeth into it and not just played, you know, I'm second fiddle to the person bringing home the bacon. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So this original production, like I said, you know, Miller wrote Willie as supposed to be kind of a smaller guy. Well, the smaller men at auditions just couldn't command the space as much as Lee J. Cobb could. And I'm going to send you some pictures here.
Lee J. Cobb was a big guy.
He was a big guy. Yeah.
He was the first Willie.
He was the original Willie. There we go. I send it to you on your text.
Right, I mean, now. I don't want to jump the gun, but we know who also played Willie, who was not tall.
Uh-huh. Yep. We'll get there.
That's why I'm not going to say.
There we go. But yeah, Lee J. Cobb was the first one, and he was eventually cast, but it was much to Arthur Miller's disliking. Like, he did not like that idea at all.
Well, he's also too powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I think Elia Kazan, the original director just saw this idea of, okay, we're seeing this guy who we think we all can look up to. He's the image of the hardworking man who's winning all the time, and he's not. Yeah. But I guess in the initial auditions, the little guys just couldn't fill the room, you know? And I think about this, and I think about this like in your role, it has become so apparent to me in my acting, even as I get older, just how important silhouette is, and just being able to gauge size and gauge what a character is going through based on how they carry themselves. And so that one kind of struck me like, yeah, here's this big, broad-shouldered, strong-jawed man who he's going through it right now. Poor guy.
I wonder if that it tells a different story. I don't know. You could play with the parallels of the country and the man.
Right.
We weren't in decline. This was our victory.
Oh, yeah.
But maybe it was also seeing the hollow victory of it. Powerful and no longer powerful, youth and age, you know, I was a powerful guy and now I'm not, losing all of that. So, I mean, but that doesn't sound like it's the story that Miller wanted to tell.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And maybe it was because people would be more interested in, I don't want to look at a guy who looks like me, or I don't want to watch a guy who's always been kind of shrinking down. And he's just wore down. I mean, in some ways, that's an interesting thing, which is I always talk about, you know, the emotional journey or the arc, you know, we talk the character arcs, story arcs. I'm going to say this succinctly. if you know where you're going, right, you're going in this direction. So, for instance, that this is this guy ends up down. Then you might want to start in the almost the opposite direction because it stretches that journey more. So I do that with animators, which is if the guy is going to lose at the end of this scene, we don't want him kind of already losing. We want him to still be hope, whatever the thing is. I mean, obviously the writing is going to dictate that. I could show you clips if I had, you know, but, I mean, examples, but that's going to be too long to go and describe. But it's about... It's about stretching that emotional journey. So in some ways, maybe there's something interesting about him starting that we see the power and then there's more of a decline because of who, what that actor brings to the stage.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, Miller finally kind of went, okay, fine. But even still grumbled about it and pouted about it in the early days of rehearsal. Because I guess Cobb, like... The way Miller put it was all of the other actors were getting the rhythm of the play. And then when it would come to Cobb's lines, it would just go off rhythm. Like it just didn't seem to work out. And I guess Cobb understood that Miller was unhappy with his performance. And Cobb apparently within the first couple of weeks of rehearsal came to him and said exactly these words, "You know, or do you, that this play is a watershed. The American theater will never be the same." And I guess after that really nice compliment, Miller was like, well, okay, you can stick around.
Smart guy. Smart actor. But, you're a genius, I say.
But it's said that by the 12th day of rehearsal, Cobb's performance started to click and the show was really cooking to the temperature of Miller's liking. Director Elia Kazan started referring to Cobb in a positive light as the walrus.
Okay.
It's just this big lumbering thing. And that was kind of the energy that he brought to Willie. Like he was just tired and like his, I did a Comedia thing several years ago and my character was based on a walrus. So in rehearsals, I just had to figure out like how to have big flippers, like in motion, like I had big flippers and that was the weight that I carried myself around. So I'm like, walrus. Okay. Willie Loam and the walrus. I guess Miller actually agreed with this and actually changed all the references to Willie as a shrimp to a walrus in the play.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
That happens all the time.
Oh, yeah. Just write something for the person. Yeah.
Well, or that what the person brings. I've even been involved in that with playwrights where what the person brings, they start shifting around to what you're bringing and they change the play. Yeah.
I love that. I love that. I've worked with playwrights who are like, that's not what I wanted. Don't do that. You're like, well, here's the thing. You wrote a thing to be interpreted, and therefore, yeah.
Yeah. Or also, your dialogue ain't that good.
It make no damn sense.
Yeah.
But I guess by the time the show was ready, Miller had this to say about Cobb's performance. He stood up there like a giant moving the Rocky Mountains into position.
Was he happy with that? It's pretty nice description, but is that fit what he wanted?
Well, it seems to be. You know, obviously the compliment paid off. Here's more from Harold Clurman's review on this. Lee J. Cobb, who plays Willie Loman, is surely one of the most powerful and juicy actors on our stage today. He displays a tendency in this part to sacrifice characterization to a certain grandiosity. Willie Loman's wife speaks of his exhaustion, and Willie himself refers to his having grown fat and foolish looking. None of these textual indications is taken into sufficient account, and what is gained in general impressiveness is lost in a want of genuine pathos.
So basically, he's too and not enough.
Yeah,
that's going to play well on audio. So the thing that worried Miller in the first place is what happened.
Yeah, in a way. But that was just one review. Here's Brooks Atkinson. Mr. Cobb's tragic portrait of the defeated salesman is acting of the first rank. Although it is familiar and folksy in the details, it has something of the grand manner in the big size and the deep tone. So I go, okay, it paid off kinda in a way.
Yeah.
Like you did see the big man, the symbol of the American dream, just kind of deflate or in this case, get turned into molasses.
A walrus. Was there, I'm assuming there was another production. I mean, I don't want to jump the gun, but in Miller's time that Miller saw.
Oh, yeah. He died in, I think, 2005.
Oh, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Later. Yeah. I forgot how long he lasted.
I know. He held on. But with this first image of Willie Loman was burned into the minds of the American theater audience. This large man who may have at one time been larger than life, slowly being crushed under the weight of the pursuit of the American dream. So this is what people thought Willie Loman was. And this kind of carried on to a lot of the rest of them. Would you like to meet some other actors who have played Willie Loman on Broadway?
Of course.
1975, George C. Scott.
Okay.
See, they're doing the same thing.
Patton.
Yes.
Patton gets broken.
Yep. Here, I'm going to send you a picture of him in that.
So I have a feeling I know where this is going of when it starts to turn. At least I know the Willie Loman that I think of the most.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when maybe, what an interesting picture.
I know.
That is so odd.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, listening audience. Oh, that is such a weird picture.
Yeah, what are you seeing?
Well, I'm seeing, George C. Scott is way in the foreground, slightly, to the left of view as you're looking at the picture, looking, I don't know, not wistful. I don't know. But then there's his son is sort of down at his shoulder, further back with his head almost slightly cocked. Scott's head is cocked. And then behind him on the side is the mom whose head is definitely cocked. And then behind her, even further upstage, is another person whose head is completely obliterated in the darkness. Yeah, right. So I guess that's telling you the importance of who these people are in the play.
Yeah, just a bit.
It's just like bam, bam, bam. It's a little zigzag of just getting more, less and less pertinent or whatever. I can't think of the word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is also something kind of interesting. He also directed this production.
Oh.
Yeah. But let's put this in perspective of time. Was this just a cash grab? Or was this a nation who had spent the last 14 years in war and were just coming out of it going, what the hell was that all about?
Yeah.
And not to mention that in 1949, America's economy was great, which emphasized Willie's plight even more, that he couldn't succeed. But in 1975, Americans were looking toward another recession and probably would sympathize with Willie, not just empathize with him or even pity him. I think the juxtaposition of doing that show at that time, I think people were like, oh yeah, I get it. And really starting to ask themselves, wait, why are we saying we're so great?
Yeah, well, there was, 1974, there was an entire generation saying we ain't so great. And going back to 1949, the whole American dream, the whole Horatio Alger myth, the whole thing of, America, you pull yourself up by your bootstraps and you can make it. So if you don't succeed, it's your individual fault.
Yeah.
And that has been the big fallacy and the big lie of the American dream, is that it's all individual effort. There's nothing systematic keeping you down. There's nothing institutional that's keeping you down, especially not for a white person, not for a white male. And, I should say really reverse. There's nothing's keeping anybody down. And so it's your fault. There's no racism. And we know whatever, all the things. And it's your fault. It's your fault, right, if you're not making it.
But by 1975,
it's starting to question that a whole lot more, and been questioning it for a number of years. In a war we should never have been in, and the economy shifting, and a lot of questioning. It was a huge time of questioning.
Right.
Questioning authority, especially questioning any kind of authority, government authority, family authority. It was a rebellious time, and really going, yeah, this whole thing this myth we've been telling ourselves, it just isn't true.
Yeah.
We aren't the greatest nation in the world.
Right.
We aren't Yeah.
So here's an interesting thing to think about. This played at Circle in the Square in New York. So it was most likely a thrust seating configuration, which to me is one of my favorites. Like, I'm getting ready to direct an adaptation of Stephen King's Misery in about a year, and I'm going to put it in thrust. So you are seeing people across from you, or you are seeing people around you who are reacting to the same stuff that you are. So I think it would be neat to watch this man, and the man is between you and somebody else on the other side of the theater who is seeing the same thing. And maybe at some point you lock eyes and you're like, did you feel that? I felt that.
Interesting.
I just thought that was so interesting. Yeah.
Well, it puts you in it too. You are now in it. You're not observing. You are part of.
Right. Right. And then here is one of America's favorite tough guy actors. Mm-hmm. We just saw him in Patton 5 years earlier. He's a big tough man, right? So so obviously they're still carrying on the Lee J. Cobb idea of let's do this big guy as Willie Loman on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a pretty neat review from Clive Barnes at New York Times. As a director, he sees the play clear: father versus son, man versus death, humanity versus society. The staging is bold and vivid, and so is the acting. Mr. Scott dares. He dares everything and anything, like both bull and bullfighter in an arena. He will physically grovel at one point. He actually makes Willie unlikable and constantly stresses the man's lack of dignity. He reveals the bonhomme of the natural loser. With his raspy voice, his face fixed in some horrid rictus of grinning despair, Mr. Scott gives us an unforgettable portrait of a man whose dream has failed.
Ooh, that's pretty freaking fantastic.
if I got that, I'm like, okay, I'm done. I'm done acting.
Well,
I just
love that he makes him unlikable.
Yeah.
And that there, because that's one of the hardest things, that he was willing to make the lead character and make Willie unlikable.
Right.
And hard to watch because of the vulnerability of, what was the other word he used in that review? Of dignity, like indignity or something.
Yeah, the man's lack of dignity.
Yeah, exactly. When you see that lack of dignity, it's so hard to watch.
He will physically grovel at one point.
Yeah. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
And good for him. Good for him for going there.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Time magazine also describes Scott's performance as, quote, bloodied by the picador, yet ready to charge again.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Great. Yeah. Oh, and here's a fun fact about this one. You know who played his son Happy in this production? Oh. Harvey Keitel.
Oh, wow. I think there's a video version of this or something. I may have seen
this. I think there might be. It's been filmed so many times.
Yeah,
so
I think I might have probably seen that.
Yeah, version. Probably.
For some reason, that's ringing a bell.
Two down, four more to go. And perhaps we'll answer that question Tracy asked about how to make it a show for today that could be relevant and resonant to today's audience. Don't look ahead! We'll get to the actor Tracy was referring to in the first thing next episode. Speaking of Tracy Burns, I'd like to thank her for her contributions to this episode, and we'll hear from her again in 2 weeks when we conclude our deep dive into Death of a Salesman and playing Willie Loman on Broadway. But for now, I'm going to have to sign off. This has been another episode of Euripides Amenities, a theater history podcast. I have been your host, Aaron Odom. Another episode will be in your ears in 2 weeks, and I will see you at intermission.